The first reading this morning is in two parts. It's from the Hebrew Scriptures, specifically the Nevi'im, or the prophets. These quotations are dated first, 680 before the beginning of our era, and second, 560 years before the beginning of our era. The first selection is from Yeshayahu, or Isaiah, and these famous words are carved into stone in the well-known King James Version outside the United Nations building in New York City. What you will hear now is a more modern translation of the Hebrew.
They shall hammer their swords into plow blades and twist their javelins into pruning hooks. Every nation shall refuse to use weapons against other nations, and none of them shall ever teach the skills of war anymore.
But the prophet Joel, or Yoel, has this to say.
Hammer your plow blades into swords, now, and twist your pruning hooks into javelins. Let those who are powerless claim, I am a warrior too.
The second reading is taken from Jody Williams's TED Talk in 2011. Those of you who don't know what a TED Talk is, there's a series of lectures that have been recorded, and you find them on the TED website, TED website, or on YouTube or various other places. They're quite extraordinary, many of them. And Jody Williams, if you don't remember who that was, won the Nobel Prize for Peace back in 1997, a long time ago now. She won it because of her work helping to rid war-torn nations of the landmines left there to maim the lives of peacetime citizens.
I'm actually here to make a challenge to people. I know there have been many challenges made to people. The one I am going to make is that it is time for us to reclaim what peace really means. Peace is not kumbaya, my Lord. Peace is not the dove and the rainbow, as lovely as they are. When I see the symbols of the rainbow and the dove, I think of personal serenity. I think of meditation. I do not think about what I consider to be peace, which is sustainable peace with justice and equality. It is a sustainable peace in which the majority of people on this planet have access to enough resources to live dignified lives, where these people have enough access to education and health care so that they can live in freedom from want and freedom from fear. This is called human security. I am not a complete pacifist, like many of my friends. I think humans are so messed up that we need a little police, some military, but for defense only.
Thank you.
Ever since I was very young, I have been personally fascinated by visions of the whole earth at peace. I used to read stories by Arthur C. Clarke and other visionaries which spoke of world peace. To be fair, Clarke's vision for an earth finally at peace takes place a full 1 billion years from now, which sort of suggests that he didn't imagine peace would happen in our lifetimes, although I am glad that he thought we'd still be around then. As I got older, I entered, as did so many of my and every subsequent generation, the incredibly influential visionary world designed by Gene Roddenberry, who suggested a future where the earth itself is indeed at total peace. No one is starving. No one is without shelter. Everyone is free to contribute to society with their skills. There is no money anymore. And there's no economic hardship for anyone. The only disruption of the peace seems to come solely from outside sources, usually other civilizations which have not yet given up their lust for conquest and control. The Star Trek universe means a great deal to many people, even people who don't usually go for sci-fi, science fiction. I also recognized that I was not alone in finding some sketched out dream of world peace, and to find that dream exciting. I would feel better in my bones, in my very flesh, after reading or watching tales of such a future. I felt energized, I felt hopeful, and I actually felt some sense of peace inside me, something perhaps like the people who tell me they feel that same thing after hearing or singing John Lennon's Imagine. Imagine there's no heaven. Imagine there's peace. I found myself more and more excited as I grew older when I realized that this dream was actually an ancient one. Not only have many in our century, like Roddenberry, created portraits of peaceful utopias in various media, but the very idea of an age of peace and prosperity goes back thousands of years. Some, especially in ancient times, saw that world of peace as being in the remote past, not in the future. The Greek poet Hesiod, for example, proclaimed that there had once been a golden age. And the late Hebrew authors, working with satire and Sumerian originals, created the idea of a peaceful gan in Hebrew, that is, an orchard, a park, or a cultivated garden that was found, they said, east of a place called Eden, or Eden, a word that simply translates into English as delight. Both the Golden Age and Gan Eden were lost, our ancestors said, and then replaced with our warfare and our obligatory poverty for some and our religious and political clashes of cruelty and disgust. But mostly people did not imagine peace in ages past, but rather they looked to the future, as I have always done, imagining a better time to come. I think of Sanazano's famous Eden-like Arcadia, or the New Atlantis of Roger Bacon, the land of Cocaina, which was discussed all throughout Europe, Tommaso Campanella's City of the Sun, the Peach Blossom Society of the Chinese. All of these celebrated future possibilities of peace for all humankind around the world. There were even attempts here in the USA to turn vision into reality, to create actual communities which anticipated world peace within their structures. There was New Harmony. There were the Amana colonies and the Oneida community. There have been feminist utopian proposals as well, utopias based on green ideas and religious utopias of both the conservative and the socialist leftist kind. Robert Heinlein and Ayn Rand even proposed deeply capitalist, anti-socialist views of how the world could be at peace, in their opinion. Nothing has come of their visions, but the Norwegians, the citizens of Norway in Northern Europe, have actually worked on building their exact opposite, a socialist and rational nation with the highest ratings in democratic practices and human development across all the earth. Individual income is almost twice there what it is in the United States, and there is universal health and welfare, subsidized higher education, and despite the intemperate dark and cold of winter at their high latitude, their happiness measurements are off the chart. It's perhaps the largest actual utopia-like place on Earth today, at least by some standards. Yet ideas are just ideas. Visions are just visions. Countries like Norway are actually quite small. Little commune-like villages like Oneida and New Harmony are very tiny, and anyway, historically didn't last very long. And Norway, even as it's small, is just one nation amongst almost 200 on the earth. And I don't think Norway would make either Ayn Rand or Robert Heinlein very happy, although I don't much care for either of their swaggering visions myself. So the idea of world peace right now has no concrete reality on present-day Earth. Now, some wiseacre made this very plain by creating a sarcastic bumper sticker found on many cars, even here in Columbus, some in the parking lot, which goes, "Visualize world peas." Peas, as in the green vegetable in a pod, cooked, mashed, and whirled into some kind of porridge. Visualize world peas. Such an image, at least for many, sort of yanks the carpet out from the peace visionaries and calls them fools. So all we have is a vision, or better, visions. But which one of the many visions makes the most sense? Myself, I happen to like what Jody Williams said in her TED talk. "What I consider to be peace," she says, "is sustainable, and it includes justice and equality. It's a sustainable peace in which the majority of the people on this whole planet have access to enough resources to live dignified lives, where these people have enough access to education and health care so that they can live in freedom from want and freedom from fear. I call this human security." Note, she is not talking about personal or even meditative peace, which she rather ungraciously dismisses out of hand as kumbaya and rainbow peace. She's clearly thus talking about world peace for everyone together, not personal interior joy. Yet it seems to me that if there will be a future in which some meaningful world peace has actually come to pass, It will not be inhabited by super beings entirely different from us. It will be inhabited by human beings exactly like us, who will continue to talk the same way we do right now, both beautifully and ungraciously. I don't think it's particularly sensible to predict that human nature, in all of its variety, will evolve towards some kind of universal psychological perfection, where everyone speaks the same language of complete emotional maturity, and where there will no longer be people who sometimes go berserk and shoot up high schools and movie theaters and summer camps, even in Norway. I agree with Jody Williams that such a vision is more wishful than realistic. And as a Nobel laureate who has seen what landmines can do to the bodies of children, I think she is well grounded in the reality of what human beings can indeed do without the slightest trace of visible remorse. And I think the same reality is made clear in the utopian world peace passages found in the Hebrew Scriptures. After Isaiah envisions weapons being changed into farm instruments for peaceful agrarian use, the prophet Joel sees reason to go the other direction entirely and tells the people to beat their pruning hooks back into javelins. In other words, I think that world peace cannot possibly mean that we will one day all see things exactly in the same way. Never is that going to happen. If that's what peace requires, then it's best we give up hoping for it. We can sing Christmas carols about peace on earth being exactly the same thing as God's glory or radiance. Or we can also light a Hanukkah candle to remember that oppression and conformity have often been overthrown only by painful revolt. And look, even those who celebrate Hanukkah every year are different from each other in how they celebrate it. This is an Ashkenazi Jewish Hanukkah. The way we lit it is the Ashkenazi Jewish way of lighting it. They always use the shamash, or helper candle, to light the other candles. Sephardi Jews, however, as opposed to the Ashkenazi Northern European Jews, Sephardi Jews, who are Southern European and Middle Eastern and African Jews, never light the candles with the shamash. But they light the shamash after everything else has been lit. Ashkenazi Jews always allow children to light the candles. Sephardic Jews prefer to let the parents do that. Ashkenazi Jews sing Motzur, an old Hebrew hymn, and eat latkes, potato pancakes, fried in oil, and also fried special donuts at Hanukkah, just like engineer Ari in our story this morning. Sephardi Jews don't know that song, recite entirely different blessings with a different pronunciation of the Hebrew, and they eat cheesecake instead of potato pancakes. These are two totally different ways of practicing the one Jewish religious culture. And neither of them is either correct or incorrect. They're just different. And world peace, if it means anything at all, means embracing differences, welcoming them, as far as I'm concerned, not obliterating them with some sort of surface unity. Benito Mussolini, who moved from socialism to fascism in his younger years, really believed in his heart that uniformity of thought, heart, and practice could be forced on human beings from the outside by imposing culture, discipline, and violence. He was wrong, of course, and his own people finally turned on him and reacted with violence to his vision of unity. Like the Maccabees, they refused to not be just free. They wanted to be at home in themselves and maintain their historically very diverse culture without punishment. The dream of a world community at peace has been institutionally embodied, at least in miniature, first in the League of Nations and presently in the United Nations Organization. But although we read about United Nations peacekeeping troops being sent into trouble spots now and then, most of the actual day-to-day work of the United Nations has been to try to improve economic, educational, environmental, and healthcare resources in the member nations. Our own Unitarian Universalist Association of Free Churches has always had a presence at the United Nations because our very principles envision world community at peace. But peace only within the context of freedom and justice being present. Our own Nancy McDonald Kenworthy represents the office, the United Nations office here in this congregation. You might want to talk to her sometime. The activities of the United Nations underscore for me that any true portrait of world peace will not, I think, portray just an end to war. It will also depict the beginnings of economic justice everywhere on earth, including in our nation, with housing, healthcare, and clear access to both healthy food and clean water for everyone. I think Norway provides a very beautiful, if not completely perfect, model in this regard. World peace means the absence of warfare as a solution to problems, yes, but it also means the presence of justice, most certainly. And it also has to mean, I think, the deliberate and ethical and painfully patient dismantling of the systems of oppression, the engines of oppression. The story of Hanukkah teaches this perhaps first and foremost, as far as I'm concerned. There is nothing good in oppression or repression ever, ever, ever. It's true, I think, there is likely to be violence when one group, usually small, oppresses another group, usually larger. In this, I think Jody Williams may be right. We have to maintain a defense of police even in a world of peace. Now, don't get me wrong. Mahatma Gandhi's utterly nonviolent and strategic approach to oppression is the one that makes the most sense to me, and I've made that clear for 14 years. As it was also clear to Dr. King, Donald Dolci, and the Protestant and Catholic women in Northern Ireland who joined together nonviolently to confront the troubles there without weapons and to effectively end that war there in our lifetime. But such remarkable leaders do not grow on trees, nor can the vision of world peace be left to the unexpected good fortune of someone like Gandhi just showing up at the right time. No, I think all of us have to be involved in creating a portrait of and upholding a vision of world peace that we can journey toward together honestly, practically, even if we feel small in power, even if we don't feel particularly courageous, even if we feel very involved, overly involved in our day-to-day demands, to give any real energy to building a future of peace. Even so, It's up to us. And our story this morning made that clear. World peace begins not with grand ceasefires alone and economic sanity and justice for all and clean water, but it begins with real conversations between real people, no different than you or I, who have historically lived in entirely distinct worlds side by side for a very long time, and maintain that conversation with joy. A vision of world peace takes place one conversation at a time, as well as with the organized negotiations of diplomats. What I remember from my early years of reading stories about peace on earth, as I said, is that every single time that vision was kindled before me, I felt pleasure and liveliness in my very body, a sense of hope and harmony unlike anything else. The particular details in any great vision of world peace, however, may not be realized. But not having a vision of that possibility, not having a vision, is very much like sailing a boat without ever raising the sail. And what sense, I wonder, is there in that?